Let me take it away.
Great. Thanks so much. Thank you guys for coming. I'm really excited to be here today. So broadly speaking, my research is driven by the hunt for wild microbes. So these, a lot of these processes occur on a microbial scale, but drive ecosystem level processes. And so one of the challenges that we face in the field is that when you make macroscopic measurements of an ecosystem, many times you miss the processes that are actually driving the activity that's happening in that system. And so a lot of the work that I've done has been to try and develop a toolkit that allows us to start to visualize what's happening when you're looking at communities of wild microbes and their interactions and their ecology. So the story I'll tell you about today, shown here, is about a charismatic system of macroscopic bacterial aggregates that I worked on in my graduate work. But first, I sort of wanted to give you a sense for the broad picture and how I think about a lot of these questions. So when I think about the world and our place in it and where we fit in, I tend to start from an evolutionary framework. If you look at this tree of life, we're here. And you step out a couple branches here along the tree of life and you've exhausted all of the visible world. And I find that incredibly humbling and exciting. And that the vast majority of the life that's out there is microbial. That's what got me hooked. And this is a little bit my view of the world, which maybe is a little bit biased, but what I'd like to convince you of is that it's not. So it's not just a matter of the diversity that's out there, but also the global abundance. So we live on a microbial planet, and if you read the New York Times science section, I'm sure you know that our bodies are microbial worlds in and of themselves, right? So this human microbiome is a really hot topic right now, and medicine has realized that we're ecosystems too. And so a lot of these methods and things have applications sort of across the scale from human health to the health of our ecosystems. To echo some really excellent writing by Andrew Knoll, our continued survival depends in no small way on understanding how our actions influence the microbial world. And I really like that quote because in many ways it's a mandate to understand the ecology of these organisms, right? And one of the problems in trying to understand this ecology is that frequently these interactions are invisible and occur in what are called cryptic cycles, where you have one organism consuming something that another one's producing and you can never actually detect what's happening. And the way I like to think of it is that these aren't really cryptic cycles. They're cryptic to us because we're not looking at the right scale. And so if you start to break it down, we just need to figure out how to decrypt what's happening. So how do we do this? How do we track the interactions of wild microbes? We're going to need a pretty big set of binoculars to look into the microbial world. And so the scales that are involved in this problem are really daunting because you move from working at single cells, which are nanometer scale, to whole ecosystems that span hundreds of thousands of kilometers. And so that's been my focus, has been trying to figure out how we can weigh some of the need for the resolution with the throughput to start to make some progress in these ecosystems. And trying to harness the throughput of a number of data-driven approaches to testable hypotheses that we can work with it at high resolution. So what am I talking about when I talk about some of the questions that we have about these ecosystems? As a microbial ecologist, some of the three basic questions that you have when you go into a microbial ecosystem is who is there, what are they doing, and how do they do it? Which essentially, if you break it down, are questions about diversity, function and activity, and then the mechanism or the interactions, right? This is a question which, over the past couple years, we've gotten pretty good at answering. Who's out there, right? And the revolution in DNA sequencing has really driven our ability to start to get some of this data. When you start to get more down into function and activity, this is somewhere where we're starting to make some progress as a field broadly, but that's still a fairly hard question. When you get down to the idea of mechanisms and interactions and actually detecting what's happening, that's something that still needs a lot of work. And so I'm going to kind of walk through some of the tools that we use and the way that I've applied them in this system that I've worked on. So this is the Sequisset salt marsh. This is a system that I first started working on as a summer student in microbial diversity course in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And this is a tidal salt marsh. And so as a part of the beginning of our course, we kind of walk out to this field site to do some introductory field work. This is one of the ponds where we would work in this Spartina marshgrass environment. If you look under the surface of one of those pools, this is what you see. It's this massive carpet of bacterial aggregates that occurs at the sediment-water interface. So if you look at this ecosystem, this is a really dynamic environment. It changes a lot over a diurnal cycle, from anoxic and sulfidic at night to oxygenated with tidal flushing and photosynthetic activity during the day. So you can see a lot of really interesting adaptations to both microscopic and macrobes, or fish and other things, in these ecosystems to respond to this dynamic habitat. So these aggregates, we call them the pink berries. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the adaptations that they have to sort of survive in this interesting environment. So you take one of those and you section through it and look at it on the dissecting microscope. This is a 1 millimeter scale. You can see these interesting networks of pink tubules in sort of a clear exopolymer matrix. And one of the things that we and others found looking at these aggregates is that if you stick an oxygen microsensor in the side here, within a couple micrometers of the surface, it goes completely anoxic. So they're able to generate these interesting niches in the center where even if the water column becomes oxygenated, they provided sort of an anoxic habitat that can shield the other organisms. This is just a zoomed-in view where you can see these islands of cells here. These are purple sulfur bacteria, which are phototrophs. If you look a little closer, this is another island of cells, and you can see these clusters of these photosynthetic bacteria and these intracellular sulfur storage granules that they have. So one of the first things we did was figure out who was there. So this is showing you a couple different sites, mixed DNA extractions from these aggregates, and showing you on this axis here the percentage of total 16S sequences, which is our marker for which bacteria were present. In blue and red here, these are two different species that dominated over 60% of the sequences that we got back. So compared to sediment, where you can have thousands of species at a relatively even distribution, this was a little bit unusual, very skewed diversity. And then you have sort of a handful of other species that are described as generally being heterotrophs, but we're not totally sure what they do. So these were the two players. The first one was something that we called PBPSB1, or purple sulfur bacteria. And this is related to organisms that are known to be phototrophs. They oxidize hydrogen sulfide to sulfate instead of water, which is what green algae would do. And they also fix CO2, so they're sort of primary producers in their ecosystems. The other organism is related to known cultured sulfate reducers. And so just to say, so and the metabolism here is that they breathe sulfate and produce reduced sulfide. Just to comment, we didn't have either of these organisms in culture. So all of these observations that we're making were just sort of hypotheses based on the physiology of their close relatives. So one of the first hypotheses that came up when you look at the known physiologies of their relatives is that you might have a sulfur cycle that could be happening within the aggregate. So you might actually have very tight coupling here and recycling of these substrates. And that was something that really intrigued me. Obviously, you would probably also have input of sulfide from the sediments, and then maybe some sharing of electron donors here from the other partner, and some other inputs from the sediments. So we were interested in looking into whether we could test this hypothesis and see if this activity was something that might actually be happening. And one of the nice things about this system is that unlike in other systems, you might be limited for input material, we could get a lot of biomass, we could get a lot of DNA, and it was relatively simple in terms of the diversity that was out there. So it was a nice sort of test kitchen for sort of working through some of these techniques for figuring out how things work. So just sort of a brief introduction to some of the tools that we're using and sort of where they fall on the resolution to throughput idea. So the first one would be metagenomics. So this would be going in, taking the complete DNA from your community and trying to reconstruct both the community structure in terms of who's there and then also the functional potential from those genes. Physiology, or looking at the net community response in terms of measuring nutrients in, nutrients out. Microscopy, so looking at the structure of the cells and where they are, and I showed you a little bit of that data already. And then also looking at tools that we'd borrow from geochemistry to work at the microbial scale and start to look at a single cell view of activity and flux. So the first thing we did here was to grind them up and extract their DNA and assemble some genomes from the community genome and try and see if we could look for pathways for sulfur redox that were consistent with the sulfur cycle hypothesis. And just briefly, I'm going to come back to some of what we've done with metagenomics a little bit later, but for a first pass, we basically found what we were looking for. So we saw complete pathways for sulfur oxidation that were related to genes in the purple sulfur genome, and in the sulfate reducer genome, we found complete pathway for sulfate reduction. So we certainly have a framework that would make this possible. But whenever you're looking at genomic data, I think a really important question to ask yourself is whether the genomics match reality. Right? Because essentially, the genomes in the organism may be a blueprint, but they're not a promise that that's what they're doing. So the jump from genomes to activity is something that I think is really important to try and fill in with the appropriate experiments. So here's an experiment that we did to try and look for some of these activities. So we put a number of these aggregates in a bottle, and we measured sulfide to try and see if we could see it being produced or consumed over the course of 48 hours on a light-dark cycle to mimic their natural environment. And what we saw when we measured sulfide with nothing else was nothing happened. They never made any sulfide, which was sad because we thought that they should. If we fed them 1 millimolar sulfide, however, we saw that compared to the abiotic control, which stayed steady, they chewed that sulfide down pretty quickly. And so they were essentially a net sulfide sink. So if we look back at our model, we were able to see sulfide going in, but never coming back out, which left us with a question here about the activity, whether we were actually seeing any sulfate reduction, and whether this was in fact the metabolism that was happening. So if we go back to our toolkit, we've sort of done something for physiology and looked at what we think the bulk community is doing. But now we have some other questions about sort of trying to go on to a higher resolution to see if we can pick out some more activity. So if you look here, this is what we did. We did some FISH, or fluorescence in situ microscopy, where we designed a fluorescent probe to the sulfate reducing species. So that's what you see here in green, are these little rods. And this image was really exciting to me because what you saw was that the two cells were extremely closely associated. So we saw very tight and specific association between these two cell types, which could help explain why we were never observing that intermediate. Because as soon as these guys might make sulfide, it was getting sucked off by the other partner. So we see a very tight coupling. And this is exactly the sort of relationship that you would expect if you had organisms that were sharing a diffusible intermediate. You would want to be well mixed and closely associated so that that nutrient wasn't lost to competitors outside of that association. So we definitely see other blue cells here in that sort of intermediate space, but this association was very close. Okay, so the next thing that we did was to actually try and visualize this cycle. So we used a 34 sulfur probe. So normal sulfur is sulfur 32. So we had an isotopically enriched sulfate compound, which we added to incubations with the idea that it could be reduced to reduce sulfide, which would then get taken up by the other partner and incorporated into their biomass. And sort of an important premise for this experiment is that all the cultured representatives and the genomic data indicated that this did not flow in reverse. So we don't see a simulatory sulfate incorporation in this species. So any label signal that we could pick up in this cell type, we would be pretty sure came from this branch of the pathway. So we also added a 13C bicarbonate compound to look for just primary production in the system as a marker for activity. So this is what our incubations looked like. We took the aggregates, we washed them free of sediment to sort of remove any of that attached community, and then spiked our labels into a pretty small volume and let them run for a few days. At the end, we fixed the cells and we sectioned them, we fixed the aggregates and sectioned them and lay them down onto a grid. The next step then is to visualize it with an instrument called the NanoSIMS, or nanometer scale secondary ion mass spectrometry. And this is work that was done with then my graduate sort of thesis committee member and now my postdoc advisor, Victoria Orphan at Caltech. This is what this massive, crazy Rube Goldberg instrument looks like. So what this instrument does is it takes a focused beam of cesium ion, just down to about a 50 nanometer spot size, and blasts it into your sample. And then your sample comes off as its component secondary ions. And then using the mass spectrometry portion of the instrument, it's able to focus that in up to 7 different masses which you can collect at once from a single spot. As you raster this across the image, you're able to generate spatial maps of isotopic abundance. And that sort of lets you track these different masses and gives you sort of a visual marker at a single cell level for where your labels are going. So this is what some of our data look like. On the right here, we have a biomass image showing you an RGB composite of the carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur. So we're just using this to pick out where the cells are. So you can see here these round cells that are similar to what we saw in those other microscopy images of the purple sulfur bacteria. And then on the left, this is our sulfur ratio image. So anything that is a warmer color here is showing you uptake of our sulfur label that we added to the incubation. And you can see here we have a lot of hot spots. And what was exciting is that these hot spots were also the same sort of size and distribution of the sulfur granules that we're able to visualize with reflectance microscopy. So this is a more quantitative view of some of that data, and you can see here on the y-axis is our sulfur ratio, and on the x is our carbon. So this is showing you transfer of the labeled compound. So this is showing you increased CO2 fixation on the x and increased label uptake by the purple sulfurs on the y. And what you can see here are control compounds that were done with an unlabeled compound are down here. And then anything that was done in the light, both fixed carbon and was able to accumulate that sulfur label. In the dark, we didn't see any CO2 fixation, which is good, they're phototrophs, but we were still seeing the transfer of that label between the two partners. So the next question was whether this activity was dependent on their sulfate-reducing partner. So we added an inhibitor known as sodium molybdate, which was able to knock out that activity and remove that label transfer. We're also curious if where within the cell that sulfur label was accumulating. So we treated them to see if we could wash it out of the sulfur globules, because this form of sulfur is very sensitive to solvents. So we washed them with methanol, and what we saw was that we were able to remove that compound, which sort of suggested that it was in the form of elemental sulfur. One other experiment that we did was trying to capture that sulfide end member. So I mentioned in that bulk experiment that we were never able to measure sulfide in the overlying fluid. But what we did was we stuck the aggregates onto this silver wire and were able to plate the sulfide out as a thin film. And then we were able to sort of analyze this sulfide that we'd trapped by this method and see that it had a sort of signature, isotopic signature that was consistent with sulfate reduction. So sort of more evidence here that we did see activity from that partner. So we were able to see this label transfer. We were able to knock it out with molybdate and show that we lost or never accumulated in the first place, that label uptake. We were also able to sort of establish that there were these pathways that made sense for this metabolism, and that we also saw a very close association between these two species. Right, I already said that. Okay, so sort of coming back to this general idea of scales, right? A lot of the work that I showed you was sort of on this end, very sort of low throughput, high resolution work. And now I want to do a little bit more work on this end of the spectrum and sort of show you some of the things that we've been doing with metagenomics to try and change how we're doing some of that data collection. So we use the berries essentially as a metagenomics test kitchen because we've got a natural community with enough biomass to do some interesting work with the DNA and sort of from a technical end, and a limited complexity system, which is important because the assembly of metagenomes is still a pretty big problem, and this was a system where without spending a ton of money, we were able to test some new ideas. So before I get into that, I want to talk briefly about what makes metagenomics hard. So if you think about genome assembly as a puzzle, where each fragment of each puzzle piece is a fragment of DNA, and you're trying to put your puzzle together. Metagenomics is essentially taking a bookshelf of puzzles, knocking it over, spilling them all out on the floor, and then trying to put it back together. And that computationally can be a pretty big problem. And if you know about puzzles, the smaller the puzzle piece, the harder it is to put together the puzzle. The way we currently generate high-throughput DNA sequence data right now is in pretty short fragments of 100 to 200 bases. And that makes the problem of metagenomic assembly quite challenging. And so one of the major obstacles is assembly. Another problem is strain variation. So if you have regions where your DNA is very similar in your sequence, and then you have a divergence among closely related strains, essentially many of the current assemblers can't handle that data, and they essentially just break. So just sort of going briefly through some of the developments in high-throughput sequencing, if you look at the trade-off between read length and throughput, or gigabases per run, obviously the trend, you want to go this way, right? You want to have really, really long sequences or big puzzle pieces and lots and lots of data. And so the data that I showed you before was generated on a GA2. So this is, you know, pretty high throughput for the time when we were doing it, but quite short read length. And then the data that I'm about to show you was done with the PacBio and a sequence platform called Moleculo, which is more out here in the tens of thousands of base pairs in terms of the throughput and read length. Okay, so this was trying to look at metagenomic applications for long read sequencing technologies. So our first opportunity to do some of this work came from working with Mickey Cortez and Tim Blaukamp at what was then Moleculo and then was acquired by Illumina, using this platform that generates 2 to 20 kilobase long reads with what's known as a sort of Illumina synthetic long read platform. We also generated some sort of standard short read data to compare it to, which was the industry standard. And then we're then able to work with PacBio to generate similar length reads, but with a completely different platform known as the PacBio RS2. So it's a different sequencing method. And the goal here was to see if we were able to reconstruct genomes better than we were with short read data, and if there was anything new and different that we could do to improve how we were reconstructing these community genomes and get sort of a new view on the ecosystem. So one of the first sort of sanity checking things that we needed to do was to see if we recovered the same taxa. Was there any major bias that was introduced? And the short answer was no. So we were comparing the PacBio data and the Moleculo data with their paired libraries shown here in the lighter color. And this is just showing you the split of different bacterial taxa versus the percentage of reads that were classified. And you can see that they all pretty much recovered similar types of diversity. The two types of data were very different. So I've mapped, these are the DNA sequence reads shown by these arrows, and they've been mapped to a reference genome that we put together in some of the data that I'll show you later. But it's important to think about these differences in the data. So if you look here, the PacBio data, even once you correct the arrows, is much, much more error prone. So every little hash here you see is an insertion deletion error. So whereas this data is very error prone, the molecular data is very accurate. The other problem that you have here, though, is that the coverage that you get from the molecular data, which you can't see as well here, is very uneven. So what you end up here is high read accuracy from the molecular data, whereas you get consensus accuracy from the PacBio data. The reason that this is really great is that because the coverage is so even across the genome, you can really start to assemble much bigger assemblies, and I'll show you that data in just a little bit. Okay, so if you look here at the total assembly size, or the amount that you were able to generate of the complete community, obviously the throughput of the short read data means that we get much, much more sequence data back, right, in terms of the amount that we're able to generate. But if you look at the number of fragments that we're able to assemble that into, this is a log scale here. So you have like a 2-log increase in the number of fragments that you have to work with. And computationally, that makes your problems a lot harder. So you're working with much, much more fragmented data, which makes this significantly more challenging. If you look here at how long they were, you're seeing your max contig size here in red and the N50, which is a measure, essentially a measure of your median size of the assembly, in blue. The PacBio data, blue the other two, is literally off the scale. We had some that were almost the size of a complete bacterial genome that fell out of our initial assemblies. So, you know, looking at this, this is a massive improvement in terms of being able to reconstruct those genomes of what we were able to do before. Oh yeah, and I wanted to point out, so this contig here, the largest one from our short read assembly, interestingly was not the dominant organism. So it was not the most abundant thing that we had. It was the most clonal organism in the community. So it had very low strain diversity and just happened to assemble really well. And this is an artifact that we see a lot of times in these short read assemblies, that the thing that assembles into a beautiful complete genome, there are a lot of people pulling complete genomes out of complex ecosystems now, but a lot of times those are not the most important thing or the dominant thing that's out there. There's something which happens to assemble really nicely as a puzzle. So that's sort of an important limitation to keep in mind about sort of some of the differences in these two technologies. Okay, so I told you a little bit about assembly and what we've done in that realm. Looking at the binning of these sequences. So binning is the process where essentially you try and figure out which pieces of your assembly came from which organisms. So you're trying to sort them back into what cells they originally came from. And so this is very much not a solved problem. It's computationally very challenging. And a lot of times, especially because we don't have close reference genomes. So you can't just map it to something that's known. We have to try and find ways to sort them into what cells they came from. And there are a number of different approaches. None of them are perfect. One way that we came up to do it was leveraging a unique feature of the PacBio sequence data, which is that it's sequencing by synthesis. So your DNA polymerase molecule is giving you a fluorescent flash each time it incorporates one of those nucleotides. If you look at this data, it comes out as kinetic data, and you can see here these are two A's in your sequence, and there's a difference here in the pause time. This lag is consistent with methylation events. So you're actually able to see DNA modifications and DNA damage in the readout format of this data, which is unique to this sequencing platform. And our idea was that we could use this information to look for a fingerprint for what genome it came from non-self, and to detect foreign DNA when it invades. But they also have suites of unique methylase enzymes that sort of modify them in unique sequence patterns. So we went in to look for those unique methylation, essentially fingerprints, and use that as another metric for how to sort the data that was not necessarily just the sequence. So we called this binning by base modification. So we pulled out these unique sequences, and the shown in red here are the or in green are the bases that we found that were modified in the sequence context around them. That's essentially what a methylase enzyme will go in to detect and then modify. And we found that if we use those, we picked up patterns that corresponded to sort of three unique bins, the two dominant organisms, and then a mixed bin of alpha proteobacteria, which, working on it a little bit more, we were able to refine into three distinct species when we split it down. So this worked really, really well and separated it very cleanly and sort of suggests sort of a new way to start to think about some of the challenges with binning. This was work that was done in collaboration with Meredith Ashby at PacBio. It was fantastic. Okay, so that was kind of some technical stuff of what we've been doing to try and get better genomes. But biologically, what did we get from these better genomes that we didn't know before? So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the purple sulfur bacterial genome. So this is what it looks like. This is a diagram where each, I don't know if you can see these, but each little dot here is a node. Each node is a DNA fragment, and each edge in this graph is showing you an overlap between those fragments. So it's called an assembly graph. And one of the questions is 100% complete if we look at the genes, the housekeeping genes that we think it should have. It's essentially in 9 major pieces. So you can see each of these different colors was a contig that came out of our assembly graph. And it's a big bacterial genome. So, you know, E. coli's genome is about 4 or 5 megabases. This one's twice that size. So it encodes a lot of metabolic flexibility, but it also has a lot of really interesting mobile genetic elements. CRISPRs, phage, really interesting features that a lot of times fall out of short-read assemblies. And I'll tell you why in just a second. So one of the questions people ask me is this bacterial genome closed, which is our term for, you know, we know exactly it's a circular genome. We've got the edges stitched on both sides. And in many ways, I think that's the wrong question, because this bacterial genome is very much open for business. It is alive. So what you can see here are some of these blebs and on these edges. But if you look at these blebs in the graph, this is an example of one of them up close, these assembly bubbles. And what these are indicating are regions of strain variation where we see structural variance within the population that we sequenced. So we didn't just sequence one cell, we sequenced a population of cells. And some of them have variation in these regions. And this is an alignment of two of those regions. And you can see this white area here is a region that is present in one arm of that graph, but not in the other. And these tend to be filled with mobile genetic elements, or transposases, sometimes phage, showing you that there's a lot of structural variance that's present in these bacterial genomes. And this is something, if you don't have DNA sequence reads that can span within two and all the way across the sequence, it just breaks the assemblers and falls out. And you don't see this data in short-read assemblies. So it sort of opens up a new realm in our ability to look at genes that move around And that are alive in a population, and they don't stay put. They move within genomes, they move between genomes, and this is sort of a new view into sort of bacterial structural and evolutionary dynamics that we're able to watch now in natural populations that you really couldn't see without this sort of new technological platform. Okay, what about the other guy? So the sulfate-reducing genome, these typically, sulfate reducers are described as some of the most important organisms for remineralization of organic compounds in marine sediments, in mud, right? They are dark, mud-dwelling organisms. Obviously, ours has sort of come up with a new habitat here in its sort of phototrophic niche at the surface. And one of the things that we found in the genome is really interesting in that respect. So we found a suite of genes encoding a putative rhodopsin. So this is a light responsive gene. It is a membrane ion channel that's photoresponsive. So when I first saw some of these mixed into our initial assembly, I threw them out. Because I was like, oops, contamination. It obviously doesn't belong there. And didn't look at it in our first drafts of the assembly. In our final assemblies, we can see that it is really nicely assembled, and it definitely belongs close to some of these genes that, if you look at the phylogenies, are very clearly delta proteobacteria. And these suites of genes, which appear to be horizontally transferred. So if you look here, this is our genome aligned with two of the closest sulfate-reducing genomes. And you can see here that there's a region of syntony in both of these, and then regions where we seem to have this island with our rhodopsin gene, and then the suite of the retinal cofactor biosynthesis genes just upstream that make the molecule that actually senses and responds to light with a conformational change. And if you look at this, the evolutionary tree of these rhodopsins, ours falls out in this sort of new sodium-pumping rhodopsin realm that had been previously characterized in a completely different group of bacteria, the Bacteroidetes. And working with my collaborator Susumu Yoshizawa, he was able to do some heterologous expression experiments and show that it actually did pump sodium in an outward direction in response to light. So that was exciting. And it suggests that we sort of need to rethink some of our paradigm that, you know, the light was influencing one of these partners but not the other. It also seems like the other partner is able to sense and respond to light. What exactly it's doing with it, we don't really know. Whether it's using it for supplemental energy generation or maybe some sort of sensory input to sort of regulate or respond, we're not sure. But it's sort of an interesting new direction to go with some of this new information. I'm going to skip this for right now. So, you know, I showed you a bunch of work in these aggregates, which I think are really cool. But if it works for these, can we explore it in more complex systems? And this is some of what I've been doing in my postdoc and some of the region areas that I think would be really interesting to go, which is to look for genomes that are actually present in wild cells, right? Because this is the unit that's being selected. And some of our work has shown, you know, obviously we've got a lot of variation within these genomes, so the ability to start to move in the direction of doing, you know, better functional prediction and population structure and evolutionary dynamics will come from having a better sense for who the genomes are in these different species. And I think some of the technological platforms for that will be both improving how we do metagenomics and also improving how we do single-cell genomics, which I haven't really talked about, but sort of in forefronts for where I'd like to see some of this technology going. Certainly building algorithms that are aware of strain assembly. So all of the assemblers and algorithms that we have right now to put together DNA sequence are designed for either a haploid human organism, pretty much is what they were all designed for initially, or a single clonal bacterial strain. When you get to a fork where you have differences either in a heterozygous human or in a population of bacteria, we don't have algorithms that can handle that right now. And so, well, there's some of them. They're emerging now for diploid organisms, but coming up with assembly algorithms that will work for massive strain variation in bacterial populations, we're starting to generate the data that we could use to do that, but we don't have the computational algorithms to handle it. And so it shouldn't be that hard. It's just sort of the next step to catch up with the data that we're actually able to generate now. So I think that's pretty exciting. So I just wanted to give you also a quick preview. Happy to talk with folks more about this later, about what I'm doing now in my postdoc. I've worked on a bunch of diverse projects over the last year, one of which was a research cruise in Monterey Bay that I participated in this early this fall. working at whale fall communities. So this is showing you sites where a whale has fallen to the floor of the ocean, exactly what it sounds like, and begins to degrade over a period of years. So we were in Monterey Canyon sampling a number of different whales and looking at changes both in the spatial pattern as you move away from this massive carbon loading event, and how it changes compared to the background community setting, and then also changes over time. So we have historical samples from these that I'm analyzing and looking at patterns of community succession and activity in response to this sort of perturbation in the environment. This is one of the cores that we pulled up here. You can't really see it well in this image, but you see these massive variations both in depth here and then also as you move away from the whale. And this was a whale that was sunk by Imbari in 2007, so it's almost 8 years old now, and we still were pulling up. This is an intact piece of baleen that we pulled up from this sediment core underneath the head. So this mud is really sulfitic, really sticky, and I'm looking at some of the different anaerobic microbial processes and microbial interactions that are happening in cycling nutrients in this kind of fun, exotic site. I've also been working on a number of projects on deep sea anaerobic methane oxidation, which is a partnership between an archaea, known as ANMI, and sulfate-reducing bacteria. Been working on some projects looking at single aggregate metagenomes, where you flow sort them and then start to do assembly of that data and figure out exactly what the metagenome is of one of these, as opposed to trying to work with the whole community. And then also working on some different new methods in fluorescence in situ hybridization to try and improve how we do some of this imaging. Just briefly looking at some exciting future directions. Sorry, I have a pun problem. I'm excited about using this system in a future lab to do some work on population genomics. So we have some data now to start to do some of this, but to start to look at, you know, how do we study these natural populations, and looking at things like island biogeography and spatial structure in this system, looking at patterns of coevolution between these two partners that have been co-occurring, we know, over decades. And then also using them as a really nice tangible system to start to improve some of our microscopy work in sort of coupling with microscopy and nanosims and some of those things that could use some more work. And then these are some of my ideas for work beyond the berries. this is a shot from the export science plan, which Dave Siegel was involved with, but putting together some of the work of, you know, other types of aggregates and particulate organic matter in the ocean. So if you look at spatial scales in the ocean, it's definitely not a well-mixed mixture going from sort of, you know, from the dissolved phase to the particulate phase. And I think this is a really exciting place to start to look at spatial structure and bacterial populations going from sort of macromolecules to, you know, major particles like of the same size as the berries that I've been working on. And the idea of looking at some of these marine snow particles and using some of the tools that we've been working on to start to study this system, which is really important in moving carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to the deep ocean, where it could possibly be either sequestered or cycled back up. There are a number of questions that I have here about genomic diversity and evolution. You know, how distinct are these particles? How are these different from those of planktonic cells in terms of their adaptation to a nutrient-rich structured environment? Whether mobile genetic elements in particular and phase variation play an important part. There's a lot of suggestion that happens in biofilms and spatial structures as opposed to planktonic cells. And then also the idea of these as possibly sort of ephemeral anaerobic habitats. So looking at some of those and then trying to tie this into more global models of how bacterial activity and export would work in these sorts of systems. So sort of some of my ideas about where this could be going. I think with that, I'll finish and acknowledge a whole team of different people that were involved in the research that I presented today, from my graduate lab with Jonathan Eisen and Mark Facciotti, to my collaborators in industry and at Caltech and elsewhere, some of my biogeochemistry collaborators. Happy to take any questions.
Of course. You went a little bit faster on this metagenomic stuff, so just a couple of questions. Comparing molecular and PacBio, can you tell us a little bit more? So molecular is basically reconstruction method, right? It's,
yeah.
It's not really, it is already an assembly tool.
It is. Yeah, so the way that the molecular method essentially works by I'm not going to draw it up, but you essentially you have your pool of DNA, and it's a dilution to extinction method is the way it works. So they work in 384 well plates. You take your DNA and you dilute it down to a very reduced pool. And so then you generate individual sequencing libraries that are barcoded from each of those individual wells. You then pool them, and now they've all got a barcode on them. So you sequence them, and then out of that data, you're then able to separate it back out so that you have your individually tagged molecules. And you can do local assemblies that essentially correspond to only what was in that well. And that makes the assembly problem significantly easier. But it also does mean that you've already done an assembly step. So they're synthetic reads. They're not actually something that was read directly off the instrument. And that's part of why we think some of the assemblies of the assembled things don't work quite as well as the PacBio data. Because places where your assembly will break, often it will still break in those. And there are sort of our stringent assembly parameters. And it'll quit before maybe it needed to. So it also, though, means that they're very, very accurate because it is already a consensus of many reads, right? So it scrubbed that out. Honestly, I think the future for long-read sequencing is not really with either of these two platforms. I think it's with a number of things that are on the horizon because, frankly, the molecular data is really exciting in terms of its ability to generate these accurate long reads for environments where maybe you couldn't assemble anything at all, right? Being able to read out directly 2 to 20,000 base pairs is fantastic. That's a couple genes in a row. And if you were trying to assemble that from a complex ecosystem, you might only get 500 to 1,000 bases, right, if your assembly is really tanked. So in some ways, that's fantastic. Practically, doing that method is expensive and it's hard. And I think some of the things that are on the horizon with companies like 10x Genomics and a number of other sort of these long-range linkage information are coming to sort of start to bring some of these hybrid assemblies together. So I think that is really exciting. So, I don't know if that answered your question.
Half of the question.
Okay.
PacBio.
Yes.
So it's very erratic. What is, again, just an ignorant question. So what's the spectrum of errors that that come up?
So they tend to, the nice thing about the errors that from PacBio data are that, and this is not true for every sequencing chemistry that they've released, but for the ones that work well that we were using, the errors are nearly completely random. So the dominant errors are insertion deletion errors, simply because you're trying to read that kinetic data as you go. Sometimes it doesn't flash quite as brightly or it moves too quickly, you miss a base. So they're largely insertion deletion errors in reading the sequence.
So really short ones.
Very short, yeah, tend to be 1 to 5 bases, something like that. And because they're so random, if you sequence to a deep enough depth, you end up with very, very high consensus accuracy. That then gives you the problem that if you want to get accurate sequences from the PacBio data, you need to sequence quite deeply, which if you're working with very complex microbial communities, gets expensive. And so, you know, both of these, I think, are sort of a foray into some of what you can do with this long-range data. I'm not sure that either one of these platforms will be the solution to working with complex communities in the short term.
But if you can assemble with PacBio and, you know, the error rate is not so bad that you can still recognize the homology, why isn't that good?
It's fantastic. It honestly comes down to a matter of cost to sequence deeply enough. So if you can't sequence your community deeply enough, and it's expensive. So the cost of a PacBio to do it for a single bacterial genome is about $1,000. So the amount of data that we generated here would have been about $15,000 to $20,000 worth of sequencing. It was done in collaboration with PacBio. So you can kind of get a sense for how that scales if you then work on a community that's hundreds to thousands of organisms. It's not practical right now. But I think what's really exciting is, and the other major limitation of both of these right now is, just to be upfront, is that they both needed about 1 microgram to 2 micrograms of DNA, which is a lot. The reason I'm really excited about 10x Genomics right now is they need 1 nanogram of DNA, and it has the ability to provide not necessarily contiguous DNA sequence, but linkage information that you can use for scaffolding and phasing, and they're using it right now to do haplotype phasing in the human genome over, you know, 50 to 250 kilobase blocks. So I think that has a lot more potential in terms of the long-term things, doing very, very similar things to what we're doing here, but possibly with much less material and for much less cost. Yeah?
You mentioned this super briefly, but you talked about the time scale of the coevolution of your two main players in the Pink Berry, and you used the word decades, which actually I thought was very surprising, because that's so short. Did you really mean that, or what do you know about the time scale, or what's your idea about the time scale?
I meant decades in that we have sequence data going back to 1997 that we know for sure both of them have been present since then. So that's like when we started generating this sequence data. So we know for sure that we have like a 300 base pair sequence of the sulfate reducer that came out of the berries in 1997. Before that, you know, I can't tell you for sure, but we don't really have a sense for how long they've been co-occurring. So I would love to figure out how to answer that question. I'd also love to figure out how, like, what the growth rate and turnover is like in these. I think it's actually a lot slower than we thought it was in terms of whether it's the same aggregates year to year or whether you get a lot more turnover and that sort of thing. So I don't know.
So I guess maybe to follow up on that is sort of what do you know or what are you interested in finding out about the different scales of mixing in terms of population genetics? So within berries, between berries.
Yeah, that's one of the first things that I would really like to do. I have a handful of metagenomes, short read metagenomes that were done from individual aggregates within the same pool. And I can tell just from a super quick look at the data that we have different strains in different aggregates in terms of the patterns of the SNPs. And then, you know, looking at, we have no idea as a baseline. Is it the same strains in all of them? Do you see partitioning between different aggregates? Is that a function of time? So I've been squirreling away aggregates every summer for a couple years now, and it'd be really cool to see if you can see changes in the levels of the different strains over time. And then also, I think they're a beautiful system for looking at, you know, spatial patterns. So we find them in pools going back through the marsh in different size aggregates. So we could do transects within a pool. We could do, you know, comparisons of the strain partitioning between these different pools. And then I think it would also be really interesting, you know, I'm not totally sure how to do this yet, but if we find different strains co-occurring in the same aggregate, I'd love to know if there's pattern, are they randomly mixed in, or do you see that there are strains emerging in like different lobes and that sort of thing? So
for example, there's presumably oxygen gradient and so the crust and the bulk, is there anything visible or?
Yeah, so.
Sims that you've done, that you, so these are sections? So do you see something at the boundary of the section that's a little different?
We didn't really focus towards the edges with the sims, although in the experiments that we did, we kept it completely anoxic, so there wouldn't have been gradients like there would be in the natural environment in the ones that we did, because we wanted to give our anaerobes the best chance to cook with our label that we could. So one thing that we do see in the natural aggregates is that there is a layer of these sort of Cytophaga flavobacteria, so some of the facultative anaerobes, facultative aerobes, around the edges. So the hypothesis is that the bacterial activity of the facultative aerobes at the edges helps to maintain the anoxic environment. So we've done a little bit of looking at spatial partitioning of the different sort of guilds, functional guilds within there, but we haven't really done a lot of in-depth imaging, and I'd love to do some more of that and see you know, exactly what zones the different ones inhabit and that sort of thing. Yes?
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I'm really curious. Do you have any sense of which group of bacteria may be producing the polysaccharide matrix they live in?
Yeah.
And if there are any, is there any evidence in the genes that point to which one might be doing it?
Yes, sort of. The genes question, I need to look harder. I'm sure it is there. I had a group of undergraduates that helped doing some work trying to isolate both of them. And we weren't successful in culturing the sulfate reducer, but we do have a highly enriched culture of the purple sulfur bacteria. And what we find is that that culture, if you grow it up really dense and start to shake it, it starts to aggregate. And a lot of these are very goopy and mucousy. So my guess is that it's the purple sulfur bacteria that's making most of that exopolysaccharide. But I would love to do some more sort of biochemistry of the, you know, what exactly that goo is. Is it polysaccharides? We're sort of assuming that it is. But I think that would be really cool. I'll have to do some more of that work.
Any other questions? All right, thanks for listening.
Thank you.